Welcome, everyone, to the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast, where we speak to interesting and knowledgeable people about how best to protect sentient beings from the harms of coming into existence. I am your host, John, an antinatalist advocate from the UK, and I'll be the main host of the podcast going forward. Before we get to today's episode, we've got a quick update on antinatalist advocacy. We're sorry to announce that, due to unforeseen circumstances, Alana will be leaving the AA team. But it's been a pleasure working with her, and we wish her well in her future endeavours. As such, Embracing Antinatalism, which was due to be our lifestyle podcast, will not be going ahead as planned at the current moment, but we will continue to work on our other projects to bring value to the antinatalist community and all others trying to do good in the world. Also, a quick update on the scheduling of these podcasts. We'll be releasing episodes on the 15th of every month going forward to avoid clashes with fellow antinatalist podcasts. We're still sticking to our regular monthly uploads with a couple of additional bonus episodes dotted about here and there, so please keep your eyes peeled for those. Last time, in our first episode of AAP, we had an introduction to antinatalist advocacy as an organisation. This month, we're going a bit broader than that and having an introduction to antinatalism both as a philosophy and a community, and I couldn't think of a better guest to discuss this topic than Amanda Oldfan-Sukunik. Amanda is a bit of a legend in the antinatalist community. Her body of work includes hosting the Exploring Antinatalism podcast, creating the movie The Effortlist, and running the YouTube channel Forever Wolf Films, a bit more about that channel later, as well as a wide range of other projects. Her work has been a tremendous help to me and many others coming into the antinatalist community, and her knowledge and experience with the subject made her, in my opinion, the perfect guest for this episode. I really enjoyed speaking with Amanda, and I'm hoping she'll be back in the future for another episode or two. So, without further ado, I bring you episode 2 of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast with Amanda Oldfan-Sukunik. Enjoy. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast, and welcome, Amanda, to AAP. It's great to have you with us.
Hey, John, thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much for having me on technically the first episode of
the podcast. Yep, the first full episode, for sure.
That is so awesome. Well, I'm always excited to see new antinatalist podcasts. This is awesome.
Great. And the topic of today's podcast is obviously an introduction to antinatalism, both as a philosophy and as a community. And although I jotted down quite a few guests that I'd like to have, like over the course of this podcast, the many episodes we've got planned, you are absolutely top of the list for this podcast. This particular episode, for sure, in terms of like your involvement with the antinatalist community and like your output over the years. So, yeah, just really, really grateful to have you on.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great. So, as all good podcasts start, should we have a quick introduction to yourself and how you became interested in antinatalism?
Sure, absolutely. So my name is Amanda Sukunik. I used to quite often go by the name of Oldfan within the community and outside of the community. Not so much anymore, but people might know me better by that name. I used to have a YouTube channel that was pretty much totally dedicated to antinatalism called Forever Wolf Films back in the old days. That was unceremoniously murdered off of YouTube a couple of years ago. Yeah. Very, very, very sad. But yeah, I started making videos on YouTube about 15 years ago or so. And then in 2010, I discovered antinatalism properly on YouTube through the videos of people like Edmendum and Derived Energy and Metamorph, who people might know as Jim Crawford. He wrote a book called Confessions of an Antinatalist. At that particular time, a little bit before Jim kind of got involved in the, you know, actually talking to people kind of thing, nobody was really saying the word antinatalism yet in the sort of milieu that I was watching. Definitely very strong talk of anti-procreation, but not quite that word hadn't quite entered the fray yet, until Derived Energy showed up and started, you know, needling people to argue vegetarian antinatalism. And then all of a sudden it sort of blew up into, there was a couple of years where there was a lot of interest in the subject of antinatalism, and it was argued back and forth, by people who were for it and against it. And you sort of had the birth of the first antinatalist community. And that was very much the original world of antinatalism that I was involved in. And I've just never stopped.
And you said that you were making videos before you found out about antinatalism. What were those first videos on?
Yeah, so I'd always wanted to be a filmmaker. So I had made one animated film before that, and that was my first YouTube video. And I'm a toy collector, not so much now anymore, but I mean, you know, I still do it occasionally. But I was a big time toy collector for many years, and so my original YouTube channel was Dragon Ball Toys. Mm-hmm. And is that one still up? That one's still up. Yep, that one's still up.
And hasn't been unceremoniously nuked.
It has been unceremoniously demonetized, but it has not been unceremoniously nuked. No, you can still go see all the videos from there. And they got pretty high views back in the old days and stuff. And so I did Dragon Ball toy videos for a long time. And then I made videos about depression, and then I made videos about antinatalism.
And you said about like the antinatalist community and the early days of YouTube. I wonder, just because I know that sort of era of YouTube in particular was really big on the religion versus atheism debates. Was there any crossover in those early days?
I mean, technically there was, because in Mendham, who was arguably the center of the early antinatalist YouTube world, you know, was very much a character of those atheism versus religion debates. I mean, he was maybe you could say a bit on the outskirts of it, but he was definitely a character of that world. So you could say that it was a bit of an offshoot of that era of YouTube, where, you know, atheism versus religion was such a tremendous, and really, I mean, for people that don't know, it wasn't just popular on YouTube.
It was all of YouTube.
I mean, he's an atheist, and Venom Fang X, and all of these people. I mean, Thunderfoot. I mean, that was some of the most watched stuff on YouTube at the time.
Yeah.
And you know, the iteration of antinatalism that came out of in Mendhamism, or whatever you want to call it, is incredibly atheistic. I mean, it's sort of, Ethelism is seen as the nth degree of Ethelism, like of atheism. Like there's nowhere else to go on. There is no God train, you know, than the sort of holy trinities of the right to die, Ethelism, antinatalism, and veganism. So, you could definitely say that it's an offshoot of that whole.
And that definitely makes sense, because the religion versus atheism debates, they did kind of morph into other philosophical social issues, politics, feminism, but also veganism. I remember
100% kind of,
the vegan debates in the early days of YouTube as well, coming from that kind of community.
The odd one out has been the right to die. I don't think that there's been a sort of a community of right to die activism that's come out of that. But yeah, it is interesting how everybody sort of, you know, for the intensity that it was, for the time that it was, and the viewership that it got, you know, those older debates, it's so incredible how everybody just sort of got sick of it after a while, and how it morphed into other things. So
no, definitely. And something we'll talk about with the community is how, like, decisions in the early days of a community can really direct they can really change the direction that the community goes in going forward, which is definitely something that we'll get to with the antinatalist community. But first, it would be great just to focus on the philosophy.
Sure.
How would you describe antinatalism to somebody who hasn't heard of it before?
Sure. So in the easiest words that I can possibly describe antinatalism is the belief that it is unethical to procreate. And this can apply to humans. It can also apply to all sentient creatures, to animals, and it can also apply to beings that will perhaps have sentience at some point, like sentient machines.
Yes.
So it is against the creation of anything that has the possibility of feeling, It can also extend to things that, again, might have the possibility of feelings. So the specter of evolution is hanging above our heads at any point. Will the plants start to wink at us at any point and start screaming? We don't know. They're not right now. But yeah, it's sort of the belief that, you know, life that can have the capacity to say ouch is the greatest problem in the universe, and it is the job of the antinatalists to try to prevent that harm.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's that kind of sentiocentric version of antinatalism, as opposed to maybe, and this might still be the most popular version of antinatalism, which is around humans not having kids. And sometimes even humans having a dislike of kids, of which I certainly don't, and has never been a feature of my antinatalism, for sure.
No, and it's never been a feature of philosophical antinatalism either. It's really been something that I don't know entirely where it originates from. It's certainly found a home on Reddit. We can definitely say that. It seems to be the most, I mean, certainly misanthropic arguments have originated in the more philosophical world of antinatalism.
Yes, definitely.
Nothing like child hate or anything of that nature. And I think that it's an odd situation, because on one hand, I mean, especially compared to the old days that I described earlier, like, our numbers are hugely inflated. Like, if you like the subreddit is almost at 200,000 members right now, which is pretty incredible. But you'll find that the vast majority of people in that community and others I would wager to bet that few of them really know who David Benatar is. Like, there's not a whole lot of literacy in actual antinatalism. You know, it's been very co-opted by other issues, like anti-work. Like, there was even at one point kind of a push to combine antinatalism, r/antinatalism, with anti-work, which is interesting. So all these other kinds of ideas and notions of what the philosophy is have kind of seeped in. And one of those things is, you know, like, oh, antinatalism is just about hating disabled children, and, you know, all the things that actual antinatalism doesn't want to have any association with. It has unfortunately become a part of the identity of a lot of antinatalists, or people calling themselves antinatalists. And that is most unfortunate.
No, very much so, because I've always viewed children as the victims of
100%
procreation. And for us to dislike the victims of the thing that we're against, it would be like vegans hating animals. You know,
exactly.
It's a very strange position. But I do think that antinatalism, to some extent, has maybe been morphed with just general complaints about life sucking.
Yeah, 100%.
And that's where I think a lot of, like, the anti-work or anti-crying baby on the bus when you're taking the bus to work, where that kind of comes from. And I think that is a lot of, like, the culture around antinatalism, for sure.
It's become a generalized boo-hoo, my life sucks and life sucks in general kind of thing.
And I was going to ask, do you think that life sucking is a key part of the philosophy, or is it an understandable position that many people who call themselves antinatalists have, but isn't necessarily part of the philosophy?
I don't think that it's necessarily a part of the way that antinatalists need to feel. Let's put it that way. Like, I think that there's absolutely nothing written in stone saying that an antinatalist has to be depressed or has to hate their lives or has to have no ambition. There are antinatalists that are very, very, very accomplished, happy people. So it has nothing to do with the felt experience of antinatalism. Do I think that an antinatalist has to be of the opinion that life at least has negatives? I think it would be weird if they didn't.
Yes.
I mean, I think that what at its core, what antinatalism is saying is that by procreating, we run the risk of creating bad experiences. Mm. And that's not to say that all lives are going to have incredibly negative experiences, but the risk is there. And we do it without consent, and it's an imposition. And, you know, that it's part of the soup of being alive, and that it's wrong to impose those bad ingredients on an unsuspecting, you know, innocent. So I don't think you can be an antinatalist and be blind to the fact that there are real negatives, that we harm and we are prone to being harmed, and those are bad things. But again, you don't have to. There's nothing that says that you have to be miserable by any stretch of the imagination.
Definitely. And the best way that I've heard it described is actually on your podcast, the Exploring Antinatalism podcast with Michael Ellsberg.
Oh, yes.
When he separated personal pessimism and philosophical pessimism.
Yeah, 100%.
And I thought that was such a good way of describing it, because the quality of my life at any one moment is kind of, I don't know if it's totally irrelevant, but it's actually quite insignificant to the belief of whether or not creating sentient beings is a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to recognize that I'm a very privileged person living a very privileged life, and most sentient beings are nowhere near as privileged as me. Yeah. So for me to base my philosophy on my own life sucking or even the quality of my own life will in many ways be, I guess, failing to look at the bigger picture, and maybe even like a lack of empathy to some extent. It might help illuminate, like if I, you know, and where I have gone through difficult times, I guess it has helped illuminate and concretize some of the arguments in my head. But I certainly don't think that the argument of philosophical antinatalism has to be based at all on the quality of any one individual life, especially the person who holds the philosophy.
100%. In fact, it must not be, in my opinion. It has to be an assessment of the of life itself.
Yeah.
You know, and looking at the at everything on balance. Yeah.
So what would you say are some of the main strengths or positives about the antinatalist philosophy?
I think that all things considered, antinatalism is the philosophy, is the possible future that has the best interest of sentient creatures in mind. And I think that I am not somebody that believes, I am somebody that believes that all paths forward are going to be a little nasty. Like, I think if we end up with a transhumanist world, I don't think it's going to be all sunshine and rainbows getting to utopia. If we stay as we are, I don't think it's going to be all sunshine and rainbows. I think if we have an antinatalist world, it's not going to be all sunshine and rainbows. Like, I don't think that better futures are won with no harm attached to them.
Yeah.
I do believe that. It's just an unfortunate, I don't want to believe that, but I do believe that, unfortunately. But I believe that that taken to its end, antinatalism is the possible future that is of the most peaceful, compassionate, kindest quality. And I do think that for all of its difficulties, it is the right thing to do. I have not in all of my my life found any suggestion of a path that is more worthy of human ingenuity and attention to try to achieve.
I would totally agree. I think the applicability of the philosophy and the solution that antinatalism provides to the world's problems, this is it's really the main strength of the philosophy. Depending on how technical you want to get into it, like, it solves some very complicated problems in population ethics. So those philosophy nerds out there, if you're listening, Derek Parfit's repugnant conclusion and very repugnant conclusion, two separate arguments. Antinatalism has the best argument, in my opinion, to those, which is that fewer individuals with high quality lives, significantly better than many individuals with low quality lives.
Right.
And this is something which this particular population dilemma, if you like, has massive sway in the effective altruism community and other communities that are trying to do good in the world. But then again, like, even if you take it away from like academic philosophy and just really practical solutions on the ground, like, you as an individual, by choosing not to have children, will prevent the suffering of all of your future descendants and all the likely suffering that your future descendants will cause through eating animals, polluting the planet, and all these kind of things. And that's just one person choosing not to procreate and choosing to be an antinatalist. So it just provides a wonderful opportunity in people's lives to do a tremendous amount of good. And then when you apply that to a societal basis, as you're saying, there would definitely be challenges in the implementation. The old question, I do think it is an important one, is like, what would life actually be like for the final generation?
Oh, yeah.
Probably not very good.
No.
But it does, I think, as you were saying, provide a future that is tangible and realistic and something that we can imagine. I mean, none of us were alive in the year 1750, and none of us lose any sleep now about that fact. None of us thought that 1750 was a bad year for us because we didn't exist. And that's just what it would be like for all of the sentient beings. They would have nothing to lose at all in the antinatalist world. But I think we were talking earlier about some of the challenges with the antinatalist community, and I do, we will definitely dig into those later.
Yeah.
But I do think some of them relate to my next question, which is around the main negatives or downsides to the antinatalist philosophy. So what would you say those negatives or downsides are?
Yeah, I was thinking about this a lot last night because you did pose, you know, some of these questions to me ahead of time. I think that this is very hard to achieve. Then there is a massive scale towards failure.
Absolutely.
Because as you know, even the massive numbers that we have now, you know, how many of those people actually know what antinatalism is, as we were just saying? I mean, there's very few of us that are really on the same page about any of this, even just amongst us. Then we got to convince everybody else, you know? And so there is a real possibility that we're not going to be successful. And, you know, it's 2023. And antinatalism is at least 100 years, antinatalist activism is at least 100 years behind vegan activism, if not significantly more.
Yeah.
There is no infrastructure. There is no leadership, really. You know, there's almost no, up until very recently, there's almost no collaboration between the activists, its activists and its philosophers. I mean, really, like, we have a lot of work to do, and I don't know how many hands on deck we really have to do this thing. And if we are poised to do this thing, well, we have a lot of stuff to, I mean, we got, you know, just amongst ourselves, like, we don't agree on a lot. I mean, your version of antinatalism is probably a lot different than mine. And I frankly am of the opinion at this point, at least, that our diversity, you know, community wide, in as far as what we believe antinatalism to be, I think right now that's a huge strength. But
we do
have to kind of come to some consensus on things like, is this only for humans or not?
is it
the animals or not? Are we going to include sentient machines if they become a reality or not? Like, these are kind of basic things, but they're tremendously huge things in moving forward. And what does it mean if the animals are a part of antinatalism? Does that mean that that veganism is as far as we need to go? Or does that mean that we actually have to consider how they become extinct? Is extinction a part of antinatalism? I mean, we can't even agree on that. Most antinatalists, there's just huge debate on whether antinatalism extinction. I mean, the mantra in the antinatal world is that extinction is a consequence, not a goal. You know, not everybody agrees with that. that's so. I think that it there's a possibility, and I don't like saying it, but there's a possibility that it is almost too advanced a human project for. Then what ability we have to actually make it happen. So it could fail. And if it does, it's an absolute tragedy. Because again, I really do think that, you know, we're told our entire lives that there's nothing that we can do about suffering. Life sucks and it's unfair and there's nothing you can do about it, but there is something you can do about it. You can say no to it and you can stop making more of it. And so we, you know, if we are able to make this thing happen, man, like, we can make the screaming stop. And for all creatures that have the possibility of, of making such utterances. And so, yeah, it'll be an incredible tragedy if we can't pull it together, but there's a real possibility we won't be able to.
Definitely. And I think there's something you were saying there about how maybe it's too advanced a project for humans. And I think this is one of the main downsides of the philosophy. It's not to frame it as, oh, us antinatalists are so smart or anything like that. But it's just that our biological desires run counter to this philosophy, and that you've got the obvious biological desires in terms of, you know, having babies, arguably, taste pleasure in eating meat and those kind of very primal ones. But also as well, it's really not surprising that antinatalism has been, has kind of been lumped in with, I don't know, life sucksism, because it's a difficult philosophy to hold without struggling in your own life with your own mental health and your own happiness. Yeah. And I think that is a huge barrier. It's a huge barrier for the philosophy catching on, because people just don't want to consider it because they think it would make them miserable. And just a huge barrier for people joining the community, because they do see a lot of understandably very unhappy people. I anecdotally and in a broader sense as well, and this would apply not just to antinatalism, but a lot of other philosophies that try and do good in the world, veganism, effective altruism, whatever they might be, that the people who hold these philosophies aren't very happy. And grappling with life's biggest questions goes against our biological desire to seek happiness and to be optimistic, which is a key survival strategy. Because if you're optimistic, you're going to pass on your kids and pass on your genes and procreate and be a productive member of society, a real go-getter. And again, you can still be a productive member of society and a go-getter. And we definitely need some of those in the antinatalist community.
We sure do. But
there is something about this philosophy which I don't know if it causes people to be, upset, or people who maybe are upset or do struggle with their mental health are more prone to adopting this philosophy. My suspicion is maybe it's a bit of both, to be honest. And I do think that's a big downside, the fact that it does go against these kind of primal instincts. Bit of a downside to this philosophy in many ways.
Well, let me a slight pushback on that. So I am not of the belief that we are programmed to want children biologically. I think we're biologically programmed to want to have sex. We're driven by a need to have
sex.
Yes,
good point. Yes.
And that the trick that the DNA plays on us, like, you can have all this pleasure, but in the end, I get my perpetuation into the future kind of thing. There's a lot of disagreement about that, but that's generally what I believe. I think that the impetus to procreate is, frankly, just as strong though as the dictates of the DNA molecule, because it's it comes in the form of incredible social pressure.
It's what our
parents did. It's the expectations that we're all born into, and those are just as difficult, if not more difficult, to. People don't like to disobey mom and dad, or the expectations of their societies. And there's an incredible amount of fear in the antinatalist community about being something other.
Yeah.
That's a big, big, big difficulty that our community faces. And there's an incredible attrition rate in the antinatal world. People are only, especially people that are active and that are putting their names and faces out there. That is, you can almost set a timer to it. There's only so long that most people can hold that together. I used to run a contest every year for almost 10 years called the Why Are You an Antinatalist contest. And it would challenge people to make their first antinatalist videos. And maybe 95% of those videos are gone.
Wow.
And some of the time it's because YouTube removes videos. I mean, that's the story with all my videos. But for the most part, it's because people self-censor. They're terrified of their parents finding out. They're terrified of their employers finding out. They're terrified of their friends finding out. So fear of social cost is really, really, really high. in antinatalism.
Absolutely. And I think you're right. I should rephrase what I was saying. You've got the biological desire to have sex, but really it's that desire not to be cast out of the group. Totally understandable. Complete survival strategy. You know, 100,000 years ago on the plains of Africa, early Homo sapiens, you got cast out of the group, you would die. So exactly. It's all of those things combined that lead people to have children away from this philosophy. More than, as you said, like that inbuilt desire to procreate and have children. And I think it's really interesting as well, and this is maybe a positive that we missed, is that once that social pressure falls away, birth rates decline. Like once we in the West get some degree of equality of the sexes, women choose to have fewer children. It's really remarkable. And does run counter to the idea that we have this,
100%.
Immutable biological drive to have children.
Yeah.
And another thing that, to build on something you were saying earlier about how we're told that life sucks and that life is hard and that life comes at you and throws you curveballs and all this kind of thing. So there is that, I don't know how to describe it, but people have these antinatalist inklings throughout their lives.
Yes.
And although that there is the social pressure and the biological pressure, and again, the two are very connected, it's hard to separate the two. It's not that hard, I find, to get people to understand antinatalism. Get them to act upon it is one thing. But when you say that, yes, life is unfair, life does come at you, you can't guarantee that your kids will have a good life. People get that. There's
a
truth that's just underneath the surface that people maybe haven't examined. And if they did examine it, then antinatalism is the logical conclusion, I think.
I don't think that people are beyond getting this. I think people have very antenatal conversations all the time when they talk about their pets. I mean, you know, some very antenatal things come out of people's mouths when they consider spaying and neutering their pets.
Oh, yeah. My cat to have a ton of kittens that they can't look after.
And have horrible lives. Like, exactly. They literally say they're practically, they're practically asymmetrying all over the place. I mean, making the risk argument
absolutely.
You know, people are able to, but I think two things happen. I mean, when you start talking about, there's an answer to that. You know, people can admit that life sucks, or they can say all these things, but then the answer being, well, that we shouldn't produce life. People kind of take that as a kind of defeat. Mm. You know, it's like I don't know if I'm allowed to curse here or anything, but people take that like we're being too risk averse. Let's say that. We're not taking enough risks. We're not tough. You know, it's a millennial thing. You know, we don't have enough dirt. We don't have enough dirt under our fingernails. You know, so we can't face life. We can't, you know, we can't produce life because we're big babies about shit. You know, sorry. But
absolutely. I mean, you know, you need to raise your warrior children to face.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of that that happens.
Human spirit. You know? You're denying the human spirit. David, if you want that in, you know, writ large, just watch David Benatar's debate with Jordan Peterson. And Jordan runs the gamut of, you know, this denies, I used to do a decent Jordan Peterson impression, but this denies the human spirit to face life's challenges and this kind of thing. There are lots of arguments like that against anti-activism. Yeah. But I wouldn't. Everything that we've talked about now and the main negatives of the philosophy, I wouldn't say that we've covered necessarily the strongest counter argument to antinatalism in any of these. We'll talk more about social pressure. But what would you say is the best counter argument to antinatalism out there?
It's really, really tough. I mean, I haven't truthfully encountered any great counter arguments in any of the academic literature. I haven't. I mean, I really can't think of anything that has really swayed me to any stretch by any stretch of the imagination. I think that there is a idea that it can only, that the way to achieve antinatalism is 100% of people are going to agree and we'll just go extinct. And anything else is possibly going to require autonomy violations. And I think that might probably be, I don't think that that's always necessarily an argument against antinatalism by any stretch of the imagination, but I mean a concern for autonomy, I'm not saying that a concern for autonomy is an argument against antinatalism, but an antinatal world fully achieved, I don't know if you're going to get there without some variety of autonomy violation. Like, I think at some point, and I don't really know what that looks like, truthfully. I don't.
But I mean,
it kind of goes back to what I was saying before, is that in order to achieve it, you might need to cause harm.
Yes.
Especially if we're talking about sentiocentric antinatalism. I mean, if the animals cannot say, yes, I'd like to go extinct.
Yeah.
Like, it does have to be human beings going, making an informed decision about what's, an admittedly paternalistic decision about what might be best for them.
Absolutely. And then taking action. Paying and neutering all of the wild animals
yeah.
so they don't eat each other alive.
Exactly.
Produce you more know, babies, you'll do that.
Yeah. So that for a lot of people, maybe for very good reason, is a line in the sand where this is just, this can't possibly be, this is all very nice on paper, you know, that the good intentions are there, but that the good intentions, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and
absolutely
this may cause a lot of damage. You know, I mean, I do think that it's a reality that you know, antinatalism taken into practice, I mean this is why I always argue for engineered extinctionism, you know, phased extinction. If this thing is going to happen, it has to be done with the utmost care.
Yeah.
So that all possible harm that could be avoided can be avoided. You can't just do this kind of thing willy-nilly. Because it, as birth rates decline, if you were to choose like a phased extinctionism, like, it will dismantle civilization as we know it. I mean, and that's a consequence of antinatalism most don't really want to think about. But it's 100% true. I mean, it's, you know, we are sort of, we have to be very careful not to be bulls in China shops.
Yes.
You know, and it could very easily turn into that. So again, I don't know if this is, for some, that can very much be an argument against antinatalism. For me, it's an argument for increased caution.
Yes.
That if, because again, I meant what I said at the beginning. I do think that next to the other possible futures, despite whatever harm an antinatal world might produce, I think it is ultimately less harm than a transhumanist world, which will require an incredible amount of birth and surgical manipulation on living things before it ever gets to whatever it thinks it's going to get as far as a utopia, or certainly a long-termist future, or any of these other possible paths that humanity and sentience can take. I think that... it is the path to no more suffering ever, you know, whereas there's no end in sight for these other attitudes and notions about what the future will be. So I don't think it's all a bed of roses, but I do think that even despite that, it is the best path. But yeah, so I don't know. I hope that answered the question.
Absolutely. But, I think that was, I think you put it beautifully. Like, I think there maybe is a tendency online to talk about antinatalism as a magic pill.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
David Benatar talked about this as well, that
yeah.
it would be easy to think that we have the solution. And
yeah.
I'm very much in the camp of, this looks like the most promising solution.
Yes. Yes.
But I don't believe that, unfortunately, in the messy and complicated world that we live in, there never really are any true, completely perfect solutions. There are
exactly.
only ever trade-offs, you know.
Right.
Growing up in a rural community, if the whole world goes vegan, people whose fathers farmed and their father's 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 family all farmed, you know, they're going to lose their way of life, and that's going to be
yeah.
very difficult.
Yeah.
I think that's a small cost to pay for ending animal agriculture and all the suffering and death that entails. But
it's still suffering.
There are never, absolutely, it's still suffering,
yeah.
And it's
yeah.
It would be cavalier and frankly, again, like a lack of empathy to yeah. not recognize that.
No,
and
we
I
have
think
to
that
recognize it.
I would say that's also the for me the strongest counter argument to antinatalism is that
yeah.
it's less about the philosophy, more about its practical implementation.
Yeah.
People often say, oh, sorry.
Yeah, sorry. No, please go ahead. Forgive me. Yeah.
I was going to say, people often say, well, what would happen if everyone went vegan tomorrow? You'd have all these animals running about. And I think, yeah, that's still less bad than the
100%.
What they've got. However, with antinatalism, I don't think, and it's not going to happen anyway, but I don't think I'd want everyone to stop having children tomorrow. Because society would collapse in a pretty bad way.
No.
And it wouldn't do anything about the wild animal suffering. Like, it's almost like we wouldn't have time to solve that huge conundrum.
No, exactly.
Where most of the sentience on our planet is. It's in the wild. And again, if you don't know about wild animal suffering, just to plug our website.
Yes, absolutely.
There are some good resources on there to show that,
yeah.
you know, the Lion King, Circle of Life, balance in nature view of the wild is maybe a bit naive and rosy.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do think that's probably the strongest counter argument that you said. It's for me, it's the best of the possible futures, but certainly not a utopia.
No. No. It's a long, treacherous way towards the kind of peace that is the best outcome that is possible.
Yeah.
But and we have to be realistic about that. I mean, I don't want to take up too much time with this, but I mean, I think that there is a tendency in antinatalism to get trapped between different fantasies. The fantasy of 100% of individuals agreeing to go extinct, that's not going to happen. That's what I'd like to see happen. I think that's what we are fighting for, voluntary human extinction. We all agree and we go from there. Or something like a red button scenario, which, yes, would violate 100% of autonomy, but would just take care of the whole problem all at once, you know? And neither of those things exist.
No.
So where does it leave us? You know, it leaves us with in my opinion, arguing for phased extinction, because you're right. If 100% of people stop procreating tomorrow, we would have chaos. It would not be a good situation.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Ethel Blaise. He was a he was an antinatalist and a nephilist promortalist that died some months ago, very tragically. But you know, he created this idea called the blue button thought experiment, where if you press the blue button, it sterilized 100% of people. And you know, would you press it? You know, for his thought experiment, would you rather press the blue button or the red button? I would not be pressing that blue button, because you would be causing an unbelievable amount of harm, extincting life on the planet that way.
Yes.
I mean, can you imagine the road down from there? All of a sudden, nobody, I mean, you know, so yeah, so it's, we have to be more, there's a real hesitance and reticence and terror of facing the practical implications of antinatalism, but it's really the whole game.
Absolutely. Know? And like you said, some of those fears are very, very well grounded. Just look at the history of reproductive rights if you're worried about autonomy violations.
Yeah.
And again, as you said about the road to hell being paved with good intentions, something that, again, Benatar brings up is that just look at the 20th century and you see some very utopian visions and a tremendous pile of skulls.
Yes, yes. No,
we are not omnipotent and we are just as prone as anyone else to...
Absolutely.
Thinking that we've got all the answers, and it's definitely something for us to be careful about and to take very seriously the things that you talked about earlier, Amanda, about the difficulties of the practical implementation, and the potential trade-offs that we would need to make. So that we've covered the antinatalist philosophy. We are planning on doing a follow-up episode in the future on deep dives of some of the individual arguments for antinatalism, for all the philosophy nerds out there, things like the asymmetry, the consent argument, the risk argument, this kind of thing. But for now, and we have been touching on it all the way through because we have talked so much about practical implementation, but now we're going to pivot to talk about the antinatalist community.
Yes.
So Amanda, as someone who very much is considering that the online community is quite young, a bit of a veteran of the antinatalist community. How would you describe the antinatalist community to an outsider?
Young, incredibly immature, rudderless in many ways, without leadership, without structure, without form, without infrastructure, lost a group of warring factions who can't agree with everything, anything really, with each other on anything, and are often, unfortunately, at each other's throats. Yeah, that is unfortunately a pretty good depiction, I think, of the antinatalist community. I wish I could, I have the deepest of affection for so many members of this community. There's so many people that are trying their absolute best. Nobody get offended. but on whole, I think we have some real issues. We have a lot of real problems to overcome.
Definitely. And as someone who's fairly new to the anti-lacist community, very much engaging online.
Yeah, welcome, and I'm so sorry.
I think that is a very apt description that you gave, Amanda. I think, though, as we were saying before, all of these problems within the anti-lacist community, they all come from a totally understandable place. There's a lot of people who really are struggling in this world as an anti-natalist. And it does result in actions which, while they might be unhelpful, they might not help create a community that we want to see, one that's driven and cohesive and everyone pulling in the same direction towards a positive outcome. We are a million miles away from that. Yeah. These actions, they're understandable. They're an understandable reaction to grappling with some pretty big questions in life, in a world that is, very far away from embracing antinatalism.
Yeah, exactly.
Shall we talk about where the antinatalist community kind of exists, if you like? Like, if I think about the vegan community, it's not just online. There's obviously vegan expert circles. There are vegan restaurants. There are vegan social events, vegan dating apps. It's like the vegan community exists in many different places.
Yes.
And people can obviously move between those different places or belong to or get involved in all or as many as they like. Where would you say the antinatalist community is, if you like?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that it is primarily still very much online. There was a period of time, like when I started, again, the center of the antinatalist world was on YouTube. There's just no question about that. I think it was, and all that sort of began in 2010. I think it was around 2010 that the Reddit started, but it really took a while to grow. I mean, it really wasn't, I don't know entirely when the Reddit community really exploded. You could say that that's where it's at right now, because I would say that that is the most active antinatalist community in existence right now, is r/antinatalism. Though I want to say it's not the only Reddit antinatalist community. There's actually quite a number of them.
Yeah.
So on whole, I would say it maybe is on Reddit that where it's existing the most. Although the character of the antinatalism as a whole on Reddit is not in the best place. I think we can all agree on that. There is still certainly some YouTube world of antinatalism, although it's really not what it used to be. And a piece of that, I mean, I explained this on Lawrence's channel. A lot of that died after the response video culture died. So once it became less of, a part of YouTube infrastructure to actually make responses back and forth to each other, it stopped being a show. It started being sort of individuals and less of like a something to sort of gravitate towards, like a building conversation. And that was very good for us. I wish we still had that as a community. There is quite a bit of antinatalism on Discord. It's pretty dead. It's really not particularly active. It was active a number of years ago. Twitter antinatalism has always been weird. It's definitely there, but it's just weird. I don't know how to describe it. I don't know how to, I've never known how to put it into words. There is a tremendous amount of antinatalism on Facebook.
Yes, and in the different groups.
In the different groups. And actually, it is where, in some respects, I think it is the best portrait of the antinatal world as a whole, because it's the most international. So yes, you will find antinatalist groups almost anywhere in the world. You know, there's an antinatalist group in Malawi. There's Arabic, different groups from Morocco, and some of them extraordinarily huge. I mean,
hundreds of thousands of members,
millions, yeah, actual millions. You know, in some of these Arabic groups from Lebanon and Egypt and. Almost anywhere you can think of, there's an antinatalist group on Facebook, but they're all dead. Like, even the really big ones, not a lot of activity. I can't tell you anything, unfortunately, about the biggest English-speaking Facebook antinatalist group because I'm banned. So I don't know. I don't know what goes on there. You're not allowed to talk about anything on that group. Like, they banned pretty much. You're not allowed to talk about veganism. You're not allowed to talk about animal rights. You can't talk about. You certainly can't talk about ethylism. You certainly can't talk about transhumanism. So I don't know. I don't know how active that group is anymore. But that was a hopping place for a long time. So I think that it mainly exists in its most active form on Reddit. There is more. Before the pandemic, there were more meetups in different places in the world, like Canada. That's starting to happen now in Germany. During the pandemic, right after the birth of Antinatalism International, Stop Having Kids showed up.
Yes.
So they're on the streets protesting away. That's really, besides, if we want to count if you want to count Vehement and like the Church of Euthanasia, it's really the first time we've had that kind of activism in antinatalism properly. So it is moving a little bit more toward outwards from the internet, but it's still mainly on the internet. I mean, there's only been one, major antinatalist academic conference. I think that was in 2017 or 18.
Antinatalism Under Fire, was that?
Antinatalism Under Fire. Yep. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So
in Prague,
in Ostrava.
Ostrava.
Yeah. And so there's a huge amount of out of the internet infrastructure that could be built.
Yeah,
that is just sort of incidentally the UK, I think, maybe is, besides Stop Having Kids and maybe Germany right now, is because you guys have Speaker's Corner and that kind of thing. You got Danny Shine. So there's more like on the street antinatalism, happening there than maybe anywhere else. But
definitely, and quite a low birth rate as well.
Yeah, well, there you go.
thank you for the rundown of like where antinatalism is. And I think you referenced earlier your video on Lawrence's channel, Lawrence Anton, who was involved, obviously, with antinatalist advocacy. I'll be sharing that video in the description for this podcast, and it's a really in-depth kind of like history of the online antinatalist activism kind of community, and I found it just so helpful watching that when I was quite new and still fairly new to the community. Obviously we talked about quite a few of the challenges of the antinatalist community, the infighting, the life suckism, the fact that they're not particularly welcoming places. You mentioned being banned for trying to broaden the conversation. But what are some of the positives of the antinatalist community, would you say?
We're incredibly creative. There's a lot of great art that's been produced out of antinatalism over the last 10 years. We're arbiters of one of the most fascinating intellectual ideas you could possibly imagine. And it's in this world where everything has been chewed up and spit out to death, where the overriding theme of the creative world is that everything has been done already.
Yes.
Antinatalism stands tall as this, like, yes, I mean, it has been done before. I mean, it is an ancient idea,
yes,
but it's never been what it is now and what it can be in the future. I mean, it is a very, still, you know, even after 13 years of being involved in this thing, it is still an incredible playground of intellectual and creative possibilities, just waiting, yes, for people to take a hold of them. And, you know, and that's besides how much good in the world it can do. I mean, there's so much potential, both in terms of the impact, the positive impact that it can have on sentient lives, but also the, you know, on our way down, there's a lot of great art that can come out of this. There's a lot of great works of intellectual, you know, prowess waiting to be created. And you know, antinatalists are, I've some of the best friends I've ever made in my whole life have come out of this community. I mean, it is, you know, whatever the general issues that we have as a community, it is also filled with some extraordinarily wonderful people who, I really have the best interests of sentient life in mind, and who are, you know, working very hard towards those ends. And we have a lot of brilliantly creative people involved in this whole thing. And that's, you know, I've said it many, many times before, but there is nothing that has inspired me more than antinatalism and, yeah, the antinatalist community and antinatalists. So, we have brilliant activists, brilliant artists, and brilliant philosophers, and that's nothing but a joy.
Definitely, I think I would definitely agree that the main positive is the just the, as you said, like the untapped potential. There is so, yeah, much potential in this community. I having come from the vegan community, where there is a lot of infrastructure, some which I think is great, some which I'm not so sure about.
Yeah.
And then seeing the antinatalist community, which doesn't have any of that, where it's sporadic and divided and doesn't have cultures of activism or cultural moments, as Lawrence was talking about before.
Yeah.
There's just so much potential there, because,
yeah,
so much potential to do good, so much potential to have a positive impact. And I think that's something that, you were talking about, like the wonderful individuals within the community. I absolutely agree. You will meet people who are, you know, very courageous in their own lives. Again, like Lawrence interviewed an antinatalist in Somalia recently.
Oh, it was
incredible interview.
I hope this isn't too inappropriate, but like the balls on that guy.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
You know, like,
yeah.
I mean, incredibly inspiring. And I've heard that kind of story over and over again from various individuals. I
mean, absolutely.
You know, for all of the fear that exists in Western antinatalism about, you know, what the impact of being open about this philosophy will mean in your life, there are just as many people in other parts of the world who are like dying to be able to
absolutely
do this,
yeah,
and I'm sorry, I'm not trying to make a joke, but like could die.
Absolutely, putting their lives are at risk to.
Yeah, and
stand up for this stuff.
Yeah, and so I mean that's it's very moving. I'm not quite sure what else to say, but I mean it's incredibly moving.
Absolutely, it's really inspiring. I think we, yeah, are a truly global community as
well. We are.
Well.
We are. Yeah.
And people from all walks of life. Like it is diverse in every way, shape, or form.
Absolutely.
And I really think that is a strength of the community.
Yeah.
So many different talents, so many different experiences, so many different, so many different ways that people can get involved and have a positive impact. And again, you,
yeah,
just meet people who just truly compassionate, who have taken on a worldview based upon, on really facing the difficult questions in life and taking a stand, not just for themselves. You know, in many ways, antinatalism doesn't benefit you as an individual, you could argue, because,
yeah,
of the social pressure and all this kind of thing. And yet they've made a decision for the benefit of others, be that their own children,
exactly,
the non-human animals, the society at large, and,
yeah,
yeah, I'm constantly inspired by people that I meet within the community, and hopefully through what we're trying to do here at Antinatalist Advocacy, we can unlock some of that potential
100%.
Going forward.
Yeah.
And that leads on to my next question. We talked a bit about stop having kids, and how activism, antinatalist activism, is quite young.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on antinatalist activism as it exists currently? And again, the main kind of opportunities and challenges that we currently have.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, it's so fascinating with Stop Having Kids, just as a first example, because, like, John, what they're doing, if I were to send you in a time machine to 10 years ago, okay, and like we're 10 years in the past, like we're on Stickam, which is a platform, a video sharing platform that no longer exists, and we're, you know, we're just antinatalists at, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning talking about what needs to happen.
Yeah.
One of the things that we would be talking about is we need to get out with signs and we need to have billboards.
Yeah.
Okay. Antinatalists have been whining about wanting signs and billboards for over a decade. And Stop Having Kids has done it.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. The one bizarre and deeply troubling part of it, though, is that it's received no media attention. None.
No mainstream media.
No mainstream media.
I think it has caught on in some of the corners of YouTube where people say they talk about these kind of things. Like, I'm obviously the algorithm feeds me this kind of stuff, but I've seen the Stop Having Kids branding in many different places, conservative places that are like, this is the devil's work moving through these people.
That's good. I mean, that's more than I thought was happening, actually.
Than I thought was going to happen when I saw that they'd started.
It's not what it has the potential to do, though.
Absolutely.
It's even the amount that it's attracted interest from conservative groups or like right wing groups. Like, I would have thought that it would be so much more.
Yes.
The kind of attention that it's received. And I wonder why that is. I don't know why that is. Because those people are hungry for new devils to,
absolutely,
you know, new scapegoats to try to, you know, blame the ills of society on. So it's like, why isn't antinatalism having an impact? Because I don't think we are yet. You know, we're not influencing birth rates. We're not, you know, the number of lives we're preventing is very minimally, you know, linked towards antinatalist philosophy at this point.
That's true. Not many outside of our own individual choice, not to
right.
have children or not.
Exactly. Exactly. And some of that's because there's still a lot of fear about talking about this with people. But also, I just don't know that we have the most effective tools. And I think that that's. I don't think we have the most effective activist tools. And look, I mean, the Exploring Antinatalism podcast is a tool of activism. I don't think I'm blaming myself. I'm not blaming the rest of the community or anything. I'm just saying, like, I don't think my tools have been very good. You know, I don't think my movie convinced very many people. I mean, I've been trying a long time, but I don't think I've found any kind of silver bullet. And I don't really think anybody else has either. And I also don't think a lot of the philosophical arguments have been doing the kind of work that we think that they do, or that they may have the potential to do. Like, I think that the asymmetry, I think that all of the philanthropic antinatalist arguments are extremely valuable. I would never cast any of them out of, they're all important tools in the antinatalist toolbox, but they don't really convince people not to have children.
Yes.
All on their own. You know, the Benatarian asymmetry, incomprehensible to most people. Just is. You know what I mean? The consent argument doesn't make any sense to people because it's talking about beings that don't exist yet. You know, the risk argument, I think, is very valuable, but it's not enough. So I think we've had some fairly blunted, not particularly great tools. I think that the philosophers have not, well, they certainly weren't created for the purpose of activism, first of all.
Yes,
so that's not something I'm blaming them on. I'm just saying that, you know, they weren't really created for that purpose, but brought into that purpose of antinatalist activism, I don't think that they've been the sharpest tools. And then mixed with that, I don't know that the tools that the activists have come up with have been all that great. So I think that there does need to be a bit of an evolution in both our argumentation and in whatever other tools that we want to bring to the party.
Absolutely. And I do think that there is a comparison to be drawn here with veganism, where certainly in the West, veganism is well known now.
Yeah.
I went vegan in 2016, so I wasn't that early in the in the trend, but I was for a while quite often the only vegan that people knew.
Yeah.
And people would say that you are the only vegan that I know.
Yeah.
And they didn't really know what it was. I now don't have to explain to people what a vegan is anymore. And there are certainly more, you know, delicious, not very healthy junk foods in the supermarkets now.
You don't have to
go to that weird hippie plant-based store that sold like one carton of overpriced almond milk or whatever.
Right.
Like it's in the mainstream, really in the cultural mainstream in the West now. The only problem is the impact that that has had on animal agriculture is still probably quite small.
And
certainly a lot smaller than it needs to be.
Yes.
And I think there's potentially a very important lesson there for antinatalists, and that is not to confuse impact with making a big splash.
Oh, yeah.
I think there's an element, the two can complement each other, but we don't want antinatalism, and I'm not sure what kind of cultural splash it could have. It's not like people can go, oh, well, I guess I'll try the antinatalist option today at the restaurant. I mean, they could by getting the vegan one. I would think that would align with antinatalism, but they're not. That's not like a thought process that anyone's going to have. So yeah, there is an element there, and I'm not really sure where I'm kind of going with this. I guess maybe I'm quite cautious about what we want antinatalism to look like in the mainstream, and I think I've been pleasantly surprised, considering that David Benatar is one person, and Stop Having Kids is one organization. I've been quite pleasantly surprised about the when they have been picked up in the more mainstream elements of culture, the kind of reaction and the kind of impact that they have had. And I do just wonder if it's really hard to tell. Like, no one's got a crystal ball, and I certainly don't. It's really hard to tell even kind of what direction we want the activism to take.
100%.
Apart from being impact focused. And what that means in practically is not all that clear, and definitely a key focus of future episodes of this podcast.
Sorry,
I feel like that was a bit of a ramble there.
No, John, I think you're 100% correct. I mean, there's only, you know, I in some ways I sort of feel like I almost don't know what to do anymore,
because
I've done the movie thing, you know, I've interviewed, I'm almost at 80 episodes. I've interviewed almost every major antinatalist possible. I've been involved in so many different projects. I've been on the streets of Chicago marching with Stop Having Kids. Like, I got all kinds of other awesome, you know, irons in the fire.
Yeah.
Like, where do we go? Like, you know what I mean? I'm not saying all of that is ineffectual or like, but in any way, or the things that other people are doing are ineffectual. I don't think that at all. But I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what is the correct path for this thing to take. I know where we want to end up. You know, I mean, antinatalism sort of starts with its own conclusion. You know what I mean? But
yes.
but we're a long way from that. I mean, a long, 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 long way. And and I don't know what, you know, is it really, I mean, obviously what we want is views. We want people to listen. You know, we want the right kind of attention. Like, we want the actual ethics to be what gets to move people, right? Like, we want people to be moved by the actual ethics. We want people to be, and we don't want it to hurt them. Like, we don't want it. We don't want it to turn into more, this is life sucking, and they collapse into depression about it. It's, you know what I mean? So we want to find some way where this can actually make people strong, but please go ahead.
I can say, and I wonder if one way we can do that going forward is by making alliances. So one thing that I have noticed in every social movement is that there's more time fighting between themselves than there is fighting what they're against.
Yes.
Some of my family are involved in the Socialist Party in the UK, and they hate the Socialist Workers Party with a passion. I just look at them and think, you agree with each other on things like Marxism so much more than the average Joe on the street. So can't you just bandy together a little bit for your own good? You know what I mean? Like,
well, I think that is... Oh, sorry.
That was going to say, just to be a bit practical and make the progress.
Yeah.
You know?
No, sorry, it froze there for a second, John, so I'm sorry I interrupted you. But I think that's very much where antinatalism is at. I think we are at a point where we have outgrown the internet cradle that this thing has been nurturing in for, maturating in for this last 10 or so years. And there's this cannibalistic element to the community where it's like it just wants to fight itself and eat each other alive. And, you know, the ethicists hate the vehement and the antinatalists hate. And, you know, there's all this craziness, and antinatalism itself wants nothing to do with vehement or child-free or ethicism. And, it's just all this constant, you know, bickering and fighting and doxing and all this other crap that goes on.
Yeah. Banning people from Facebook groups.
Yeah. You know, so it needs to grow outward. Like exactly what you're saying. It needs to find other avenues to have these conversations. It needs to find other ears, other eyeballs. It needs to build alliances. And I think, in my humble opinion, we are fortunate because I've always believed that antinatalism is the next step in a lot of other existing conversations. Absolutely. So I think antinatalism is an enormous missing piece to the conversation on veganism. I really do. And animal rights. I think it is absolutely a missing part of the conversation in the right to die.
Yeah.
In
climate activism,
all
futurism, long-term,
all of it.
Trajectory of humanity.
Antinatalism has been a tremendous missing piece of all of those conversations. And I think that it's just a matter of finding the people that will welcome antinatal voices into those arenas. And I think it's a long road, but I don't think it's impossible.
I definitely agree. And this might sound a bit self-serving, because this is obviously the aim of antinatalist advocacy. But I do think that the ways forward will be on... there are two key focuses in the way forward. And the first one is obviously impact. And from someone who works in the charity sector, genuinely, a focus on impact is actually quite rare.
Yeah.
Someone who's worked in the charity sector and also worked in... done a lot of vegan advocacy. It's often around what the activists want to do and what feels right and what feels... the most consistent with this other thing over here.
Right.
And actually having that impact focus is quite rare, which is why effective altruism took off. All the charity work that had gone on for hundreds and thousands of years before of human civilization, all the philanthropy effort, philanthropic efforts. I can never say that word.
Okay.
I read it multiple times a day in my day job. All that effort to do good in the world, and the fact that in the last 10 years or so, EA has really taken off by saying, okay, let's really, really try and focus on what works. It's really telling. So there's that one thing. But then I also think a related point, again, related to like building alliances, is just creating a nice antinatalist community.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much potential here, so many good people, and so much potential that I think is lost with the infighting and the bitterness and the negativity. And
yeah,
anyone who joins the antinatalist subreddit, they might be a child hater. They might, you know, hate their job or whatever it might be. I believe that there's probably something there that we can work together on, and that there is some, there is usually some sort of principle related to avoiding bad in life somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which ties back to what you were saying right at the beginning, Amanda, about recognizing the harms in life. And I think there's something around that that we can bond about and take positive action going forward.
I think so too. Look, I don't think that the negative aspects of the community are going anywhere. Not anytime soon anyway. I think they are here to stay. I don't think that there's any way of putting a lid on it. But I do think that what will alleviate some of that, what will push everything into a better direction, is exactly the work that, you know, you and Lawrence are doing. And again, building bridges to other places, you know, showing a more positive, kinder side of the antinatalist community. I mean, that's the best tool towards our future that we've got.
Definitely. And thinking about the future, as we come towards the end of this podcast episode, what projects are you currently working on that you'd be happy to share?
Well, so let me just say that I have a lot of stuff in the pipeline right now, a lot. And I unfortunately can't really talk about any of it. But yeah, some really exciting stuff on the way. I will say that a piece of it will be out in a couple of weeks. I don't know exactly when. So look forward to something. I will shout it from the rooftops as soon as it's out, so won't be able to miss it. I am certainly continuing my collaborations with Lati Hairi, so he and I are doing a lot of things together, and some extraordinarily exciting things on the way from the two of us. And then I, of course, will be continuing the Exploring Antinatalism podcast, which will on the 1st of August be releasing its 79th episode. I can't say who it's with. The 80th episode after that is going to be with probably my most famous guest yet. So I'm extremely excited about that. But again, I'm sorry to be so cagey and secretive at the moment. But exciting things on the way. But that's all I can say for now, unfortunately.
Great. Thanks, Amanda. Was there anything else you wanted to say about antinatalism as a philosophy, as a community, anything that we might have missed?
Not really. I'm so incredibly, and I mean this sincerely, John, I'm so incredibly excited to see you and Lawrence working together. I think everything that you guys have on the table and that you want to do is exactly the correct way forward for this philosophy. So I can't wait to see the way that everything that you guys are working on, how it develops and everything. And what else can I say? I think that anybody listening to this that's interested in becoming involved in antinatalism, I said this, I'm pretty sure on Lawrence's channel too. I mean, try to just stay your course. You know, if you're somebody who's interested in antinatalism because you have a real interest in alleviating the suffering of sentient creatures, you're doing something really important. And so if you have, try to find allies within the community, if you can. Try to block out all of the noise. You know, don't get too wrapped up in, the bullshit of the community, the kind of stuff that's really going to eat up a lot of your time and energy. It is a real issue that, as I said before, we have major attrition rates in antinatalism. People do not have the stamina for this philosophy. So if you are somebody that's interested in antinatalism and being an active antinatalist, take your time. Don't put yourself out there too much too fast. I didn't show my face in the community for my first year of being an antinatalist. So do everything at your own pace. Don't let people put pressure on you to do things too fast.
Same for me. I'm just going to say 2 years of me being a card-carrying antinatalist before I did anything remotely public.
Yeah, so, and that's the way to do it.
Taking that time at
all. No,
think
no, he did it exactly.
Try not to burn out.
Exactly. Burnout is real.
You're not ready for.
Exactly. Yeah, that's very, very wise advice. It's exactly the way. So yeah, so do things at your own pace. Don't let anybody put any pressure on you. But I'm, you know, I for one, and I'm sure John feels the same, we're so excited that you want to be an active antinatalist, and I for one can't wait to see what it is, you know, the new antinatalists produce. So yeah, welcome to the community if you're out there, and you know, take caution, but but yeah, it's good stuff.
No, definitely. And as we've talked about quite a lot already, there can be quite a lot of negativity around antinatalism as a philosophy and a community. Yeah. So something I'm trying to do with every episode of this podcast is to end on a positive note. So what is something that you're positive about with respect to antinatalism at the moment?
I can't say that this is everybody's experience, okay? But I'm only just speaking from my own life and my own experience. I don't know that there has ever been something more positive in my life than antinatalism. It completely changed my life for the better. I sort of was, I'm not going to sit here and say that my life has incredible direction now, or that I'm, you know, somehow like, but I am at the best place in my life now, and a big portion of that is because of the antinatal life that I've lived for the last 13 years. I mean, I went to graduate school because I wanted to be a better antinatalist. I created the best artwork of my life out of my love and passion for antinatalism. I've found the best friends of my life because of my involvement with antinatalism. You know, I can't get into detail, but there's a lot of really exciting things in my life on the way and moving forward. And like, most of it is because of my antinatalism. And so, I understand that it's really easy to get kind of wrapped up in the negatives, but, antinatalism is not darker and more depressing than life. And I think you have to keep in mind that antinatalism is the thing that is combating the real darkness, which is the black hole of pain that procreation puts each of us in. This is the thing that actually is the cure for it. And so there's real positivity in that. I'm not sure how to quite end that, but I really don't. It's been an incredibly positive thing in my being. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing, Amanda. I would definitely agree that antinatalism has been a wonderful, positive thing in my life. Thank you so much. Thank you, obviously, so much for today's podcast, but also thank you for the tremendous amount of effort that you've put into antinatalism over the years. And yeah, I definitely, there won't be any kind of drop in output, I'm sure, going forward.
Oh, no.
Yeah, huge thank you. You've given so much of your like life force towards this, the treasure trove of like online kind of resources and the podcast and everything really helped me come into the community, and I'm sure
there are many
others out there who would say the same thing as well.
Thank you so much. It's been my absolute privilege and honor to be an antinatalist for as long as I have, and 13 years in, all I want is more. So I'm very, very lucky. So thank you, John. I really appreciate it. And congratulations to you. And it's been an absolute pleasure being on the show.
Thank you. All right. Thanks, Amanda. And thanks to you for listening. Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Antinatalist Advocacy Podcast. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. To find out more about AA, including careers advice, donation recommendations, and different ways to get involved, you can go to our website at www.antinatalistadvocacy.org. To keep up to date with what we're up to, feel free to follow us on your favourite social media platforms. Links to all of the above are in the description. As always, we hope you'll join us in our antinatalist advocacy.